It is good to be with you tonight, good to be with you again. If my math is correct, it's about 54 weeks ago that I was here on the summer series last year, and looked forward to being back with you. Appreciate the invitation. Enjoyed talking with Mark a little bit before we began this evening, and always good to be with you. And sorry my family couldn't be here, but it's a school night, and it's a couple-hour drive or so, and we homeschool our children, but we're mean. We start at 8:30 no matter what. So if we had gotten home tonight really late, we would start at 8:30, and my wife said that ain't happening. So they're at home going to church at 11th Road tonight, and I'm glad to be with you, but looking forward to being back with my family again tonight, later on tonight. I appreciate the introduction that Mark gave me. I always am just honestly embarrassed because somebody asks you to send a bio, you're not going to tell them, you know, I'm a terrible, awful person that you don't want to listen to or something like that. But the introductions always make you sound better than you really are. But hopefully tonight we will learn from God's Word together and be encouraged together. And I hope if you didn't already, you'll turn back to that passage in Joshua 14. I'll meet you there in just a few moments. You know, we live in a time where very often we are just talked down to. Everything seems to be negative. There doesn't seem much that's positive at all. And if there is, it doesn't seem that we focus on it very much at all. It seems that you can't do anything on your own. You can't build yourself up very well. And if you do, well, it's just because something in our modern world brought you up. And I think sometimes that negative mindset can even affect how we read and study the Bible. Here's what I mean by that. Sometimes all we ever focus on are those passages that talk about the bad things in this life. We can memorize verses and quote verses like, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Or there is none righteous, no, not one. Romans 3, 23 and verse 10. Now, are those biblical passages? Of course they are. Are they true? Yes. Are they ones that we need to know and understand? Yes. And sometimes that mindset even goes into how we relate to those biblical men and women. We look at a life like the one of Abraham. And sometimes, instead of focusing on the times where he had a moment of triumph, we find ourselves almost connecting with him when he made those moments where he lied about his relationship with his wife, Sarah or Sarai. We see a life like Peter. And for a lot of people, Peter is one of their favorite people in the Bible, but often it's because of his mistakes. But we only think about when he went into the sea or when he constantly stuck his foot in his mouth, and we sometimes forget to remember, that almost made sense. We sometimes forget that he then also had moments of triumph in his life. Did he make mistakes? Of course he did. But that's not all he did. And sometimes that way of thinking, that negative, everything's bad, affects everything around us. Do we need to focus on the fact at times that we have sin in our life? Yes. Do we find some connection with those people in the Bible who made mistakes? Of course we do. But tonight I want us to think about something extremely encouraging. I want us to look at a life, and it's one that sort of drops through the pages of the Old Testament. Caleb is one of those people in the Bible that we don't have 25 chapters written about him. But it's amazing in this particular account in Joshua 14 how we see a life that has been lived faithfully for God and now has a moment of great triumph. You don't have to turn back there, but the setting, as far as what Caleb is rehearsing now as he's saying, give me this mountain, is found all the way back in Numbers chapter 13. And recall that it's in that chapter that the people of Israel are basically on the very banks of the Promised Land. They are ready to go over and take that land. They are ready to walk over and finally receive that land that God had given them. And those 12 spies are sent into the land to spy it out, to see what it looks like, to see what exactly is there. Possibly, maybe even some military strategy, but that's not really told. But they're sent into the land just to sort of map it out, see what's there. And you remember the people wait, and then the spies come back. And 10 of those spies have that report that could not be any more negative. The people are giants. The cities are fortified. We can't fight against it. In fact, we were like grasshoppers in their sight. Two, Joshua and Caleb, also know those difficulties are there. You may have never thought about the fact that Numbers chapter 13, Joshua and Caleb do not say, those people aren't big. They do not say, those cities aren't fortified. They admit there are obstacles there. But both of them, through the implication of what they say, tell the people, God has already given us this land. Let's go take it. It doesn't matter the people are big. It doesn't matter that we are small compared to them. It doesn't matter what kind of cities they might have. It doesn't matter what kind of armies they might have. None of that matters because God has already said, this is ours. Let's go take it. I guess people haven't changed all that much. The saying in journalism is, if it bleeds, it leads. And I guess that was true on that night as well in Numbers chapter 13. Because the people very easily believed the report of the 10 spies. It's all bad. There's nothing good about this. We can't do it. There's no possible way we can take this. It doesn't really matter if God's on our side or not. In fact, Moses, I don't know what you've been thinking. Let's just go back to Egypt. My question when I read those passages where they say, let's go back to Egypt, is, had they forgotten what was back there? Because you'll recall, there are a couple of times where they even describe what they remember. What do they talk about? Remember that? Let's go back to Egypt where there are leeks and melons and garlic and onions. And I want to sort of take a time machine and fly back to that time and land right in front of them and finish their sentence for them. And whips and slavery. Have you forgotten that? But Moses going back there is going to be better than getting destroyed by these huge giants with fortified cities. Every adult who was fearful on that night would not enter the promised land. At that time, except for three, Joshua, Caleb, and Moses. Now fast forward 40 years. Moses has made his presumptuous mistake in the wilderness. He will not enter either. And so from the fearful adults on that night, only Joshua and Caleb, those two faithful, trusting spies, are the only two who will enter the promised land. It's interesting that if you do the math, if there was some way to know how often someone died in the wilderness, we're never told how many people died in year one or year two or year three, but the numbers basically run to the fact that over those 40 years, an average of six of those adults died every single day. Joshua and Caleb had known that fear 40 years earlier that the people had. Now they've seen hundreds of thousands of their companions die in the wilderness. And even that's not going to stop them. And that's where Caleb enters the story. And famously in verse 12 of our text says, give me this mountain, literally give me this hill country. There's a part of this land that is mine. God promised it to me. Moses said I could take it, and now I'm going to take it. You ever feel down in this life? You ever feel like you can't really do much of anything? Tonight I want us to notice from this text four characteristics from Caleb that with God's help will help each one of us conquer mountains. Number one, as you read through this text, and you guys up there will have to follow along. I forgot to get the clicker. That's all right. Number one in this text, Caleb had commitment. He had commitment. And this commitment was more than just trying to gain the hill country. We could think, well, he's committed to that cause. 4 years ago, I was going to get it. Now, I'm going to get it. Well, there's more commitment than that. Because if you notice in verse 9, we're told that Caleb had the most important kind of commitment. And Moses swore on that day, saying, sure, the land which your foot has trodden shall be an inheritance for you and your children forever. Why? Because you have wholly, W-H-O-L-L-Y, wholly followed the Lord my God. That was 40, now 45 years earlier. 40 years in the wilderness and now 5 years of conquering. What had changed? Absolutely nothing. Joshua could now say, Caleb, just as Moses said 45 years ago, you had wholly followed the Lord, that is still exactly the case. 45 years of complete faithfulness to God. That word holy, as found in that text, is a Hebrew word that meant to be to complete, to satisfy, or to accomplish. Caleb, you have a faithfulness, you have a commitment that is completely satisfactory to God. What an amazing statement about this man. Through all the wilderness wanderings, through losing those hundreds of thousands of probably friends, possibly family members, you've continued to be faithful. You've continued to be committed. It's very similar, at least in concept, to what Jesus told us when he was asked, what's the greatest commandment of them all? A very paraphrase, he basically said, love God with everything. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Be totally committed to what God has given you to do. Be totally committed to the Lord your God. God never asks us for just a little. He asks us for all. He asks us for everything that we have in every relationship, every aspect of our lives. He asks for total commitment. Why? Well, number one, he deserves it. But also, number two, he realizes that if we only give half effort, we're really not going to make any progress whatsoever. You might be reminded of when Elijah met up with those prophets of Baal and Ashtoreth on that hill, and all that amazing story of the men jumping around and all those things, trying to get the gods, their gods, to send fire down. It didn't happen, and Elijah prayed about, what, a five-second prayer, and the whole thing's consumed. It's amazing. But do you remember the challenge that Elijah gave to the people before he talked to the prophets? He said in 1 Kings 18 and verse 21, how long will you go limping between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow Him. But if Baal is God, follow him. You see, you want to try to follow God and Baal. That's your choice. But if you do, you're going to be limping through life. Does that not sound a little bit, at least have an echo in something Jesus very famously said, that no one can really serve two masters? Matthew 6 and verse 24. Now, I know in the context he's talking about God and money or God and mammon, but the principle is always true. We cannot, it is impossible to serve two masters, because Jesus went on to say, you're either going to love the one and hate the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other. You can't pull it off. Caleb stayed wholly committed to God. He didn't go limping through life. He was completely committed. Luciano Pavarotti, the famous Italian tenor, was later in life giving an interview about what made him what he was. And in the interview, he said this. He told this story. He said, when I was a boy, my father, who was a baker, introduced me to the wonders of song. He urged me to work very hard to develop my voice. Arrigo Pola, a professional tenor in my hometown of Modena, Italy, took me in as a pupil. And I also enrolled in a teacher's college. On graduating, I asked my father, shall I be a teacher or a singer? Luciano, my father replied, if you try to sit on two chairs, you will fall between them. For life, you must choose one chair. I chose one. It took 7 years of study and frustration before I made my first professional appearance. This is Pavarotti. It took another 7 years to reach the Metropolitan Opera. And now I think, whether it's laying bricks, writing a book, whatever we choose, we should give ourselves to it. Commitment, that's the key. I say choose one chair. What that opera singer got right, we need to make sure we understand our spiritual lives. We need to choose one chair. We need to remain wholly committed to God, as did Caleb. You got a mountain you need to overtake? Be totally committed to God. Number two, in this text, I see character. Caleb was a man of character. Well, he must have been a really fascinating individual. Caleb must have been one of those guys that you just kind of wanted to be around. Because here he is in verse 11, I am still as strong this day as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then. 45 years later, I'm as strong as I was back then. Let me go do this. Now, we're not told anywhere in the text by the writer of Caleb's how strong. None of that's told. And let's go do it. Let's get to it. is that Caleb was still the same person. He was a man of character. 5 years later, in the promise of God. And again, think of all the things. He didn't lose a bit of it. He could God. I think we can sometimes forget that they didn't get to set up some tent right on the edge of the river and just wait for the folks to come back after 40 years. Walk over to the promised land and camp out in Jericho and just wait for the people to join them a few years later. They had to walk through all this too. Caleb never once lost trust. Character is what we are when things are different. Real character is not life. It just isn't. It's easy to be a person of character when things are going well. It's easy to be a person of great character, of great morals, when everything's fine. But when times are difficult, that's when real character is forged. And his character is more than one decision. It's a lifetime of decisions. When Oscar Wilde arrived in the United States in 1882 for a visit, he was pretty well known for being arrogant, and he proved that. Because when he landed in the United States, or came to the United States, he was asked, "Do you have anything to declare?" And he looked back at the person and said, "Only my genius." It's 15 years later, as he waste, he wrote these words. He said, "I have been a spendthrift of my genius. I forgot that every little action of the common day makes or unmakes character." Every little one. Isn't that big of a deal? Yes, it is. Because that little decision is building character. And whether I'll be able to make the proper decision when things are quote-unquote bigger, when things are quote-unquote more important, when things are even more public, those little tiny decisions I make to trust God and follow His ways or not, that's what forges real character. Character isn't built when I'm standing with my family and we're standing in the back of the auditorium shaking people's hand on Sunday morning. You know when character's made? Character's made when I'm on the internet late Friday night. That's when character's built. Character isn't built when I'm at the youth devotional. Character's built when people ask me about the party Friday night. That's when character's built. Caleb, 45 years, and I'm still going to trust God. You got a mountain you need to conquer? Be a person who daily walks with God and builds character. Number three in this text, I see that Caleb was one who had confidence. And obviously this comes from the statement that gives us our title. Give me this mountain, or give me this hill country, depending on the translation you have in front of you. And obviously this wasn't some sort of confidence that was built upon arrogance. Caleb wasn't saying, "I'm the greatest military person who's ever walked the face of the earth. It doesn't matter what's over there. I'm going to go." He wasn't saying that at all. He had confidence in the God who had made the promise. That's where real confidence is actually built. Christians can have confidence. I think sometimes we get the idea that if I'm a Christian, I've got to kind of worry all the time and be just a little bit nervous all the time and kind of wonder about everything. No. Remember what we're told in the book of Hebrews, that when we pray because of what Christ did, we can boldly go before God's throne. Not just out into the world. We can boldly go before God's throne. That's not saying we're arrogant about it. It's saying that we really trust in the work of Jesus Christ. And the same is true in our relationship with God the Father. You and I can have confidence in this life, not because of us, not because of the strength and power that we have, but because we walk with one who has all the strength and all the power. And isn't it good to know that we can get that sort of confidence through the Creator and Sustainer of the universe and not have to seek it from other people? Some of you may remember several years ago there was a special on PBS about Abraham Lincoln, and they went to the Library of Congress and found some very, very unique items from Abraham Lincoln. Daniel Boorstin at that time was one of the directors of the Library of Congress, and in that special he brought out a little wooden box, and on the outside of that box was engraved contents of Lincoln's possessions or something along those lines, April 15th, 1860, whatever the year was, April 14th, 1865. It was the night he was assassinated. What did he have on him that night? There were five things in that box. Some of them won't surprise you at all. There was a handkerchief that had his initials embroidered on it, no surprise. There was some spectacles, or a spectacles case, actually. Oddly enough, it was actually repaired with string. Lincoln was famous for doing things as cheaply as he possibly could. There was also a penknife, no surprise, for a boy raised in the country. There was a purse that contained a $5 bill of Confederate money. But the fifth item was the most interesting. In that box were some very old, very worn, some even torn, newspaper clippings. And what's interesting is, as Boorstin talked about that, he said this: the clippings were concerned with the great deeds of Abraham Lincoln. And one of them actually reports a speech by John Bright, who is a British statesman, which says that Abraham Lincoln is one of the greatest men of all times. Today, that's common knowledge. The world now knows that British statesman John Bright was right in his assessment with Lincoln. But in 1865, millions shared quite a contrary opinion. The president's critics were fierce and many. His was a lonely agony that reflected the suffering and turmoil of his country ripped to shreds by hatred and a cruel, costly war. And then he said this: there is something touchingly pathetic in the mental picture of a great leader seeking solid old newspaper clippings as he reads them under the flickering flame of a candle all alone in the Oval Office. I tell you that story to say here was a man who history now, whether you agree with everything he did or not, history now recognizes was one of the most important leaders who ever walked the face of the earth, not just our country. And yet where did he get his confidence from? He had to cut it out of a newspaper. You and I will struggle if we try to get our own confidence from our own press clippings. You and I can conquer mountains if we get our confidence from the one who created those mountains. Caleb was a man who showed confidence, not in himself, or not through himself, but through God. Caleb wasn't the only one in the Bible who struggled. You might think of the Apostle Paul, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, that thorn in the flesh. No, I don't know what it is, and no, I'm not going to guess as to what it was. But it was something that greatly bothered him. And what's interesting is Jesus' response. Because you recall, Paul prayed, said he pled three times, take this away. And if you let me paraphrase, Jesus' answer was basically, I'm not going to take it away because that's not where your strength is. Your strength is in me. That's our confidence. Number four, Caleb also was one who had courage. Caleb was not going to say, you know what, there's no obstacles anymore. There's nothing hard about this. He was not going to say, there's nothing difficult about doing this job. We know that anything worth fighting for is going to be overcoming struggles. There's no way we can just walk through this life and do great things and never have to struggle to do that. And so in verse 12 of our text, Caleb talked about the Anakim who were in that land and that they had fortified cities. Now, the Anakim are mentioned quite a few times in the Old Testament. It's pretty interesting. Sometimes they're the ones that are just called the giants in the land. The name Anak or Anak was a masculine name. What's interesting is it actually is to a female goddess of the Philistines whose name was Unka, O-N-K-A. You see similarities there with Anak. And some scholars suggest that the Anakim were the bodyguards or the inner elite warriors of the royalty of the Philistines. They were big, strong, tall. Your best, you put them in front of you, who's going to fight? Nobody's going to come against that. The most famous, of course, is Goliath, and some of them from the Anakim. He might have actually been from that line of people. He was a Philistine, for sure. But the point of it is, Caleb is facing a type of people who struck fear in the hearts of so many. But what's his response? God told me I can take it. I'm going to go do it. I'm not going to look at their size. I know it's there. I'm going to admit it's there. I'm not going to do something that he was willing to admit is a difficulty, but said, with God, I'm going to do this. If I were to ask you to name senators from United States history that you know, the name Edmund Ross, would probably never be on your list. You probably would never think of his name. What's interesting about this man is that now some political historians say he's one of the most important senators who ever lived, even though his name appears on exactly zero works of legislation. He didn't sponsor a single bill, not a one. But here's his story. Edmund Ross was a senator from Kansas. He considered his time to be one of the up-and-comers, and possibly even in the White House. That this would be the next senator turned president. They out of office knew they needed 36 votes to get him out. They were sure they had 35. They didn't know about Edmund Ross. And so they badgered him every day. Say yes, say yes, say yes. And what's interesting is Ross would never say yes or no, but he would consider it and think about it. And so his vote was considered shaky on the day that Johnson's impeachment came up. I didn't know this, so I was researching this, but the day came for the impeachment trial, they actually scalped tickets. I didn't know they had scalpers in 18, whatever it was. They said the tickets went at an extreme premium. I'm like, okay, now we scalp football tickets. Back then they sat on impeachment trial. The world's changed, I guess, but they began to go down the row. Yes, 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 no, all the way down. After about 16 votes, it was Ross's turn. And everyone knew how every other senator was going to vote. They knew his was the swing vote. So the chairman said, Mr. You, Andrew Johnson, guilty as charged. Now, before I give you his answer, let me tell you what Ross later wrote. He said, I looked into my open grave. Friendships, position, fortune, and everything that makes life desirable to an ambitious man were about to be swept away by the breath of my mouth, perhaps forever. You know how he voted. His answer was not guilty. What's interesting is what happened afterwards. Another politician from Kansas sent a telegram, a wire, to Ross that said this, Kansas repudiates you as she does all other perjurers and skunks. He was completely destroyed as a political leader. His family was threatened even to the point of death threats because of this vote. He said to his wife, reportedly, millions cursing me today will bless me tomorrow, though not but God's struggle it has cost me. What's interesting? Right. Because you see, 20 years later, Congress and the Supreme Court agreed that what Ross had done was correct in giving a fair hearing instead of deciding it before time. He was then given governorship of what was the territory of New Mexico. He was given a lifetime pension, which for that day and time in our government was extremely rare. You'll never see his name on a piece of legislation because he didn't write any. The man who taught us what courage meant. When everyone else was saying, yes, let's do this, he said, my conscience won't let me. Courage is needed. Because this lesson tonight is not meant to say everything we do is just always easy. Get on God's side and nothing's ever difficult. That's just not the courage is also possible. Because it's not courage because I just have to make a decision on my own. With the very hand of God saying, I'll lead you through this moment of courageousness. And even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I won't fear any evil. Why? Because he's with me. 85 years old. 45 years after a night of them said, give me this mountain. What mountain is it in your life? What mountain is it in this life that God will help you to conquer? If you're not a person forged in those difficult, my home is just falling apart, we can't deal with this, yes, you can. If it's a mountain in your business life, things are to be a Caleb, a mountain conqueror, not just a mountain climber. Who tonight needs to go not to a mountain, but to a hill called Mount Calvary to find the blessings that only come just the Christ and God the Father? If that's you, will you come as we stand and sing to encourage you?